This is John Tait, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee at his home near Chesterfield in Derbyshire on the 13th of November 2001. John Tait.
We had this standing rule of a sort of 3-day communication point. If you didn't communicate within 3 days, they didn't hit the panic buttons particularly, but they flagged it up that you hadn't heard. If a week went by and you still hadn't heard, then perhaps you would start to get concerned. And the concern would grow with each passing missed radio sked, until such times as they decided to send search parties and what have you. But the ethos of the Antarctic was such that, you know, chaps just sort of took off on a general... for a general area of destination. The Directorate of Surveys would say, right, we will, this year we're going to survey 65 south, you know, 20 west or something like that. Give you a grid reference. And you went into the grid reference and surveyed.
Okay, well...
Get rid of that.
I'm glad I wasn't wearing my headphones at that point. let's just do the interview bit by bit, if you like. Then.
Yeah, sure.
Exactly what we're doing. I mean, normally I just say, let's just chat about the Antarctic, but I'd rather just be a bit more specific.
Yes, indeed, and I think that's right, because chatting about the Antarctic, we haven't got enough hours.
Tell me what was happening in here as you were on that zodiac.
I was very thrilled. First of all, that we were actually going to make a landing or attempt to make a landing on Detail Island, because it wasn't really on the itinerary. And then to be chosen by the expedition leader to go along to Detail Island together with John Smith, who had been there as a winterer, was very, very exciting for us. The trip through the ice probably looked a lot worse than it was. We had, as you know, 3 expedition staff on the Zodiac plus the 2 of us. In and out of the ice floes, there was never any real problem. They were very competent operators of the Zodiacs. And it was just a question really of picking the route. And as I say, probably looked a lot worse from the ship than it actually was. We were never in any great problem. But as we got nearer and nearer to Detail, well, John and I were more and more excited. And they allowed us to be the first ones to step onto the island when we made the when we got to the island.
I thought I saw somebody in a red suit trying to kick a bit of ice away.
Oh yes, but that was, I think.
Tell me about that.
That's par for the course. Basically, you lean over the side with either your pole, the oar, or your feet, and just boot the bits of ice to stop them going under. They can go under the Zodiac and foul the propeller. And the propeller's pretty well protected, but it gives it a hell of a clout now and again. So the idea was to keep the bergy bits from going under the Zodiac, keep it clear, and that's what you saw. We also dropped one of the expedition staff off on an ice floe so that he could get a photograph of the Zodiac with us in it. And again, that was quite a common occurrence in our days. You could do that without too much danger.
So step onto the island for me.
Well,
I'm going to cut my questions out.
Of course, yes. Sure.
Self-contained answers.
Right.
So step onto the island for me.
We made the landing in a small bay, which was separated from the base hut by a small hill. So as we landed, John Smith was the first to step on, and then myself. The expedition staff had agreed that that should be the thing, and they took photographs of us doing exactly the same. And John and I scrambled literally through fairly deep snow up this hill onto the top, and there before us was the base hut. Exactly as I remember it. Exactly as John remembers it. Diesel drums, or drums of diesel scattered about, boxes scattered about. Apart from the fact that the part of the hut was drifted over, it could have just been the base as we had remembered it some 30-odd years ago.
In a nutshell, describe to me why you were there in the 60s.
I was there in the 60s as a result of a request by our authority to go to Detail Island to check the itinerary of the base and to check whether or not it was still in good shape, having been abandoned in 1958, some 7 years previously. We were surveying in the area, about 20-odd miles away from Detail Island over the sea ice. We travelled to Detail, three of us with three dog teams. The second day we were there, the wind blew up and blew all the ice away. So we were marooned, effectively, on a small island in great comfort because we had a whole base to ourselves, which was fully stocked apart from coal. There was a shortage of coal, but they airdropped coal, bags of coal to us. And there we remained from September through to January. The guitar, there was on the bass, as I say, lots of personal effects from the guys who had abandoned in 1958. Quite suddenly, they were given an instruction, sledge out over the sea ice to meet the ship, virtually instantaneously. They didn't quite leave plates of porridge on the kitchen table, but it wasn't far off that. There were still unpacked bags and personal belongings lying about, one of which was a guitar that had, over the years it had been abandoned, the strings had pulled the guitar bridge away from the sound box, so it was broken and it didn't work. But I played the guitar, so as one of the things we did, or I did, whilst marooned, was to cut a guitar shape out of a piece of wood, fix the fretboard to it, which was quite sound. The strings were still okay. Put the bridge in. I also knew a bit about basic electrics in those days, and cannibalised the earphones from the radio room that was still intact, although the radios didn't work, for the coils inside the earphones. And I fitted the coils into the guitar, and it actually made an electric guitar noise. That was my great pride and joy, and I was sorry I left it when we again received a very quick instruction that the ship would be in to relieve us in the January, within a couple of hours. Gather your stuff together and get ready to board. We did, and I left the guitar behind. When we went back 35 years later, there in the lounge, propped up in the armchair that I had used, was the guitar. Quite amazing. It didn't work. It was the strings had, in fact, a couple of the strings had broken. But nevertheless, there it was as a reminder of my time. And I left it there. I figured it should be left there as part of the base.
Lovely, thank you. Good. Tell me, if you wouldn't mind. Tell me about when you came out of the Hutton. We're going to leave.
Yes, our visit was much foreshortened by the weather. Again, I mean, the weather was the prime reason we were marooned in the first place. But we had made our way on the Zodiac through the pack ice with the ship always in sight. Snow and low cloud had blown in and we lost sight of the ship. So the expedition leader decided we should cut short the visit, which, instead of being an hour or two, turned only out to be only 10, 15 minutes, which was a great shame, but nevertheless, it all pays to take the safe decision. So we scrambled back up the hill and loaded into the Zodiac and set off on a radio bearing. We were in radio touch with the ship, and that was fine, and they gave us a bearing. The expedition leader had got the compass and etc. And then, as we made our way through the pack ice, the squall blew away, and there was the ship, some distance away, but nevertheless right on line. So everything was good, and we went on the ship and had a good dinner.
You were late with me.
Yes.
He also gave a press conference. I recorded, and I'll ask you about that. I'll tell you about that later on.
All right.
Remind me. That's lovely. That's fine. That's.
I wouldn't want to say too much about abandoning. I mean, what are we talking about? 1968, are we? Mm. When it was abandoned.
I'm recording again now. Tell me what you know from what you've heard about the abandonment of Deception.
Okay. Well, Deception, the British base at Deception, was in the lee of Mount Pond. Deception Island was volcanic. It had a certain amount of volcanic activity during the time I was there in 1963. Hot fumarole springs and such like. But in 68, Mount Pond decided to disgorge itself of whatever comes out there, and it all slid down and did away with the British base, or all but, which was a great shame because it was a very comfortable base. It also did away with the Chilean base, which was some 6 or 7 miles around the coast. The British boys were able to get out of the base and make their way onto Cathedral Rocks, which seems to be the safe place at the time. But nobody was hurt, I think. That was a good thing. But the British base, it finished it as a place to winter over, which was a great shame because it was the crossroads, basically, of Antarctica. All the ships called in there, personnel landed and exchanged ships, and it was a staging post, a very comfortable base, big base. And sadly, it's no more. It's just a ruin.
Very attractive ruin, isn't it? Not attractive, very evocative, really.
Indeed, yes. One or two things, when we went back on the trip last year, one or two things were quite obvious. Those of us who had wintered there prior to the eruption, we were familiar with things like the graveyard. There was a graveyard there with whalers' graves in it because it was on the site of an old whaling station. That, of course, had disappeared. The graveyard no longer existed. The stone monuments that were there had disappeared. The ice and ash and what have you from the eruption had gone straight across there. The British base was famous for having a well and having fresh water, which we in fact dug in 1963. It was worked out by the surveyors that fresh water would be 22 feet down below the floor of the base hut. That was the sea level. And they figured that the water that we'd find there would be fresh, as opposed to being salty. And indeed, they were right. I can't remember the exact depth, but it was 22 foot and 2 or 3 inches when water seeped into the hole we were digging, and it was fresh. And then from then on, the Deception Base was even more comfortable because it had its own continual supply of fresh water, which was pumped up from the well, and so you could have baths and you know, endless hot water, which was a great luxury. You didn't have to go out and cut snow blocks and tip them into the tank if you wanted a bath. I mean, great luxury at Deception.
Were you about the time of what happened to the well and the volcano?
As far as I could make out when we went there, we looked down the well, but it had moved. So presumably there'd been subsidence there, and whilst you could see the top of the well, you couldn't see the bottom of it. It had all moved and filled in and collapsed. So,
speaking generally about Antarctic bases, if you hadn't got the luxury of a well, I mean, nobody's actually ever said this to me on tape. How did you get your drinking water?
You melted the snow.
If you could ask the question without me having asked it before, so I need to say, in order to get drinking water, we had to melt the snow. If you just tell me the process.
If you didn't have a well, and Deception Island was the only base, to my knowledge, that had a working well, the only source of fresh water that the base had was melted snow or ice. You had a big 500-gallon copper tank, which it was the job of the gash hand, the kitchen assistant, the cook's assistant, to keep filled with blocks of snow, lumps of ice, and that was melted through the Aga cooker system, and that was your only source of water. And so, if you wanted a bath, and you didn't have very many baths, because you had to go and get your water to have the bath, you had to go and get your snow blocks. So it was something you didn't have too often. But and probably a visitor to the base would guess that, because whilst we weren't exactly filthy, we all had our own peculiar scent, I'm sure.
Very delicate way. It's a Radio 4 way of saying it. Tell me about... this is going out on Christmas Day, and of course sure. Christmas Day was high summer in the Antarctic, but there was a kind of... Well, first of all, there were two celebrations. I presume you kept Christmas Day, but there was also a second celebration.
Midwinter's Day.
So
yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yes. Christmas Day, of course, we kept Christmas Day. It was always a busy time for the bases, because it was high summer. Invariably there'd be a relief ship in the area, if not actually at the base. If you were lucky enough to have the relief ship at the base on Christmas Day, then you took Christmas Day on the ship with the fresh food, etc., that the ship would have. If you were... not if there wasn't a ship on base, then you kept Christmas Day. We didn't have a turkey dinner, of course. We'd probably open a tin of ham. But we would get changed. Some of us would have a shave. We would put on our suits and our ties, and we would keep Christmas much as we had been used to in the UK, of course. We weren't able to distribute presents. Sometimes if the ship was there early, we would get the Christmas cards, and that would be good. But by and large, it was a nice dinner, as well as we could make it. A much more relevant celebration was that of Midwinter's Day, which was very much the Antarctic deep winter, June the 21st. All personnel would be on the base at that time, because of course at Christmas time, if it was a field base, very often a lot of the field personnel would not be on base for Christmas Day, and they would then be taking Christmas in their tents. But Midwinter's Day, invariably all base personnel were there, so that was a much more relevant celebration. People would open carefully hoarded bottles of wine, and there would be an issue of beer. Again, a commodity which you might think, well, why only a very limited amount of beer? Purely because of the space it took to ship it down. You could ship a lot of bottles of whiskey for this in the same space as you could ship a dozen cans of beer. So we had a lot of whiskey and not much beer. But we always had an issue of beer on Midwinter's Day. That was a great celebration. It would usually end up with a sing-song. Somebody would have a guitar and we would play whatever we could remember, and everybody would just go to bed feeling very, very happy. And we'd get up in the morning feeling very, very delicate, having done justice to the alcoholic supplies which we had carefully hoarded on the previous months. So that was a good day.
Was winter the long winter? Well, tell me about the length of winter and the lack of sunshine and what effect that had on your psyche, which presumably, I imagine, resulted in the need for a big celebration.
Yes, I think it was part of it. I was never conscious, and I don't know whether anybody else was, of being too affected by the sun disappearing. Life on an Antarctic base could be very busy if you wished it to be. It could also be very much less busy if you wished it to be. You were entirely your own master. You had certain tasks to perform, but beyond that, there was nobody saying, you know, get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and so on and so forth. But most of the people I wintered with were all of the busy kind. So there was always plenty to do. And so the midwinter time, when the sun had disappeared, was very much a time of sort of make and mend. On the sledging bases, you'd rebuild your dog sledge, make new harnesses for the dogs, make sure the base was in good repair. The other more static bases, again, a time for repairing, making mend, diesel overhauls, tractor overhauls, aeroplane overhauls at Deception, of course. They had they overwintered the two Otter aircraft there, and they were stripped down and rebuilt during the winter period. So, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't too dramatic. Somebody would probably remark, well, that's the last we'll see of the sun. At Stonington, which was the southernmost base we were at, no more really than probably 4 to 6 weeks. And it never really got dark. The sun was never really too far over the horizon. There was always a twilight. And of course, there was always a twilight at night because the reflection of the snow was never really pitch dark. So it was never too dramatic. As far as I was concerned, there may have been other people who were more affected than me, but it was never something that I was too concerned about. It was something that you expected.
I've been asking the others, and it doesn't really matter which base you use as your example. You don't have to say which base it is particularly, but I'm wondering if there's something quirky, something unusual about one of the bases you spent time in the Antarctic.
Just,
do you want me to turn off?
Yes, I want to blow your nose.
I'm back in business. Please tell me the story.
Deception, Deception Island base was unusual insofar as it was very close to two other foreign bases. The Chileans at Pack Base, which was about 5-6 miles just down the coast, and then the Argentinian base, which was some 15 miles across the bay. The beauty of that was that you did get a connection, visiting with the bases.
There's the word invitations you're looking for. You did get invitations?
Yes, there were invitations, particularly to national festivals. Independence Days, they liked the British to be represented over there. We didn't have a similar, we didn't have anything. We didn't celebrate St. George's Day or the Queen's birthday or anything like that. We just had open house. But the interesting point was that in 1963, we were still at the process of deciding who owned the British Antarctic, or the Antarctic Peninsula. The Argentinians laid claim to it, the Chileans laid claim to it. The British were there first, so we opted for possession is 9 points of the law type of thing. But particularly the Argentinians were very keen on promoting their ownership of the peninsula and the all the islands. So they used to present us with a protest, an official protest from the Argentinian government. This would be delivered to the British base with all due ceremony. The Argentinian base was a naval base. It was personnel, they were all Argentinian Navy personnel. The Chileans were Air Force personnel. And the British were, as ever, odds and sods. We would receive this protest note from the Argentinian base commander with due ceremony, and that was always an excuse for a party. So they would be delighted to deliver the protest note, and then we'd have a party. With the, we knew they were coming, they would radio and say, we're coming to deliver a protest note. Fine, you, come across, we'll see you on Wednesday. That was good, and then we'd have a party, and they would stay overnight. Excuse me. And then, of course, the converse was true, that we would answer the protest note from London. This would be sent to the British base by radio in code, and it would be the Admiralty Code. And on British base, we had this Admiralty Code book, which was an enormous tome with lead covers, with the instructions that it should, under no circumstances, fall into enemy hands, because the whole integrity of the British forces would be jeopardised if this code was ever to get into enemy hands. And, of course, that was obviously a wartime instruction, which didn't apply to us, unless you could imagine us running down to the base with this damn book and chugging it in the sea if we were ever going to be invaded. But we used to have to laboriously decode this note from that we had received from the UK, from the government. We had to use the code book, decode it into normal English, and then we would go and present this, which would be a note which said, "Britannic, Most Britannic Majesty, deeply regrets, etc., etc., and duly protests the presence of the Argentinian," and so on and so forth. And then we would ring, we would go on the blower to them and say, "Look, we've got an answer to your protest now. Oh, good, good, bring it across, and you'll come and stay for 2 or 3 days." And we'd love to go to the Argentinian base because they had fresh meat. They had a big fridge that they dug into the ground, and they had sides of beef in there, which were frozen, of course. And so we delighted to go over there and have some of this fresh beef. That was good. And again, we'd dress up in our suits, and we'd take our suits with us and our ties, and be very official for about 5 minutes. And then we'd all relax and become very good friends.
Lovely, thank you.
Yes, not at all.
I mean, what I'm trying to do is just make, I want to make it quite clear for the listeners that it wasn't, just a nice trip. I mean, there were sadnesses about the trip too. Tell me about this tragedy at Stonington, and explain this tragedy at Stonington.
Yes, I think it goes without saying the Antarctic is a dangerous place. And whilst it may have seemed that everybody had a jolly good time, there was always an element of danger around the base and certainly out in the field. The particular incident that you are talking about, two chaps from Stonington in 1966 went out on a sledging trip really almost a dog training trip, a bit of a jolly, really. They camped in a place where there was a lot of accumulation of snow. They probably wouldn't have known that, as they were both new to the base. What happened, obviously, is a mystery and will ever remain so. But when they were discovered, they had clearly been caught out in some sort of blizzard. Instead of pitching the tent, they had dug a hole in the snow, which was a method of surviving a blizzard, but not really a tried and true method. It wasn't something you would use if there were, and that if you had still got your tent. But the rescue party found the site. They found one chap several yards away from the snow hole. All the dogs had been buried and were dead. The chap away from the snow hole was obviously dead. He had frozen. And the other guy had remained in the snow hole but was stood in the entrance to it. Dead, frozen. One can only piece together what might have happened. Two men in a snow hole, a dog team, very, very fierce weather in the area where they were. It was well known for the katabatic wind, which was the very strong winds which came down off the polar plateau. There would be a tremendous accumulation of snow. For one reason or another, one guy decided to leave the safety of the snow hole. It may just have been he wanted to relieve himself, or it may have been some trouble on the dog team or whatever. For whatever reason, he left the snow hole without the protection of a rope, presumably in the very, very bad visibility. He lost his way, couldn't find his way back to the snow hole. His companion presumably realised that he'd been gone for longer than he should have been, so he stood in the entrance of the snow hole to try to give him a guide. Presumably they were shouting, or he was shouting. The mystery of it is why the chap in the snow hole remained standing in the doorway, in the entrance to it, and died there. That is a mystery. A couple of days later, the rescue party found them, and of course everything was dead, and they were brought back to Stonington Base and buried with ceremony and a big cairn erected over their graves. A mystery which all too often is the case in the Antarctic. You don't know what happened because there's nobody left to report back.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
What in a nutshell, why did we not get a sign to what went wrong with that plan? Without laying too much blame on.
No, it is a very simple. We find this out in retrospect. You may have been aware that on the trip, the sister ship of the Orlova had been caught in the ice north of where we were. Just a week or two before, she had had to be rescued by, or pulled out of the ice, guided out of the ice by an icebreaker. Now, unbeknown to us who were on the Orlova, the captain had received an instruction that under no circumstances repeat, no circumstances would he was he allowed to take the ship into a situation where it might get stuck in the ice, because apparently the costs that were involved in the icebreaker pulling out the other ship were very, very high, and they were not costs which marine expeditions were prepared to pay or wanted to pay. I mean, obviously they'd have had to, but they wanted to avoid that at all costs. So, sadly, the Stonington trip was clear water or nothing. We're all fairly convinced that the ship could have got in without too much trouble. There was only thin pack ice. And indeed, you remember the radio message we had from the Debenham Islands, which was just round the corner from Stonington, from the Argentinian base there. They were shouting that there was no ice and could we come in and they would be delighted to see us and so on. But the captain had got this instruction. And of course, it was very frustrating to us because we didn't know that at the time. We didn't know why he wasn't going to take any risk at all. But that was his instruction, so there was nothing he could do about it and nothing we could do about it. But it was a great frustration to us all to be so close and not to get in. And even more frustrating, we understand that since we got into Marguerite Bay, other cruise ships have made the journey now, and Stonington has been visited by a cruise ship. So the Holy Grail, if you like, has been discovered.
I'm actually thinking, and I just have to make sure my facts are right, that we were the first tourist ship to get that far south. How do you describe that?
I think we were the farthest south a tourist ship had got on the peninsula route. They made a specific point of that by cruising down Marguerite Bay to a point further south. So at that time, the vessel we were on. At that time, the vessel we were on had got a furthest south position of any cruise ship. Now, since then, there certainly has been at least one other cruise ship into Marguerite Bay that has visited Stonington. So probably the furthest south has been a record that we held is now held by somebody else. Yeah.
Okay. I think let me try. I'll stop again because I didn't want to see your notes working. Start from scratch. Do you want this?
Okay. Communication with folks back home didn't basically exist, other than the annual mail drop. Whenever the relief ship came in, they brought stacks of letters. And if you had a mother like mine, you got one a week, all numbered, which was a continuation of what Auntie Lil's done and what Grandma's done and all this sort of thing. But you had no other communication, so it was very good. But in addition to that, the BBC ran a programme called Calling Antarctica. This was a weekly programme, and the BBC would go and interview the parents and friends of Antarctic personnel. They probably do one or two people per programme. You were advised that it was your turn by BAS in Port Stanley. They'd let you know with 2 or 3 weeks' notice to make sure, A, that you were there, and B, you were expecting your folks to be on the programme, and that was great. It was a general programme with interest for everybody, and then they would say, "Okay, guys, it's time for the personal bit. We've got tonight. We've got John Tate and Jim Fellows. So if you're there, John, here's your mother," and so on, and so that was and you used to get one of those A year. You were on the programme once a year, and that was a good thing.
And was that broadcast from Port Stanley?
No, it was broadcast from the UK on the BBC World Service. And very good reception usually. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but presumably
it would have been relayed
and targeted to Antarctica, because we didn't have satellites in those days. When one arrived on base, you had your own specific job. That's the job you were hired to do. In my case, on Deception Island, I was engaged as the diesel electric mechanic. But there were various other jobs on the base which had to be apportioned once the base personnel had gathered together for the new year. And these were really given out by the base leader. Things like...
I have to stop you because I'm hearing the... So let's have another go at this. This the story.
Okay. As I said, you were engaged by British Antarctic Survey to do a specific job. There were surveyors, geologists, etc. And I was taken on initially to do diesel electric mechanic. Of course, there were other jobs on the bases that were given out by the base leader once all the base personnel had assembled for the year. If you had boats, you'd have a boatman. There was always a dogman. That was the guy who was responsible for the veterinary side of dogs. And carpenter. Anybody, you know, who a sort of... penchant for chopping bits of wood up could become the carpenter. Well, my first base was Deception Island, and the first night we were gathered around the dining room table, the new base personnel and the old base personnel, the base leader was doling out these various tasks, and we'd got a carpenter. One guy was very interested in that sort of thing. Then he posed the question, all right, who knows anything about dogs? And nobody, we all sort of looked at one another and nobody answered. And he sort of said, well, you know, come on, somebody must know something about dogs. We've got a dog team out there and he's looking after. And again, still nobody picked up on that. And so he was becoming a little sort of frustrated. And he said, well, you know, anybody got any idea? So I ventured forth. My mother has a Maltese Terrier. He said, right, you're it, you're Dogman. So I became Dogman at Deception, and that was the start of a dog and man association that I really enjoyed all the time I was in the Antarctic, all because my mother had got a Maltese Terrier.
Did you